Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and today's program includes Paul Gilding and Richard Heidenberg, and they talk about what kind of economy we will have as the economic crisis meets the environmental crisis.
Let's have our next audience question.
Well, that was a nice lead-in, talking about change and triggers and famine. Famine sometimes will trigger the UN mustering its reserves and bringing in food to the very worst hit areas. But what's going to trigger safe, effective, available, and affordable birth control coming in too?
Yeah, good question. And I think the answer is, again, the crisis. I think is that we saw in China an example of you know, what we would consider to be draconian population control. I think that Like the solutions, as you point out, are all waiting to happen. We know what to do on population. We know what to do on birth control. We know what to do in food production. We know what to do in everything. We just haven't decided to act yet, right? And so when do we act? We act when we recognise the crisis is underway. And I say recognise the crisis underway as opposed to the crisis being underway, because the crisis is underway. The only thing we're missing is the end of denial. So once denial ends, I think, then you look at this as a mechanical kind of economic political process. And they say, what are the levers that we can pull? And one of them will be absolutely birth control, no question, and making that available. One of them will be more localised food. One of them will be renewable energy. Now, we know what we need to do. We know how to do it. We can do it fairly fast once we decide to do so. So we're just sort of waiting for that trigger to unleash the potential.
Part of birth control is educating women in developing countries, which stabilizes
it
fertility rates.
Yeah.
Yes, next audience question. Yes, sir.
Thank you for the opportunity to ask the question. I've read consistently that the cost of oil companies of new oil is like $200 a barrel. So what do you think of the concept of forcing a breakup of these vertically integrated companies so the exploration would have to be an independent company?
Interesting idea. I haven't heard a figure that high. It depends on the resource. I've seen costs for development of new production capacity anywhere from $60 to $80 a barrel, and then of course, if you're talking about stuff like oil shale, it certainly would be much higher. Yeah, I think that's a good strategy to explore a breakup of vertical integration to force the all of those new costs of exploration onto companies that wouldn't otherwise be able to afford it, and that would shut down the system effectively.
Mm. There's a few lobbyists who would get in the way of that one. But.
I think just one more thing on that is that the idea of too big to fail, you know, has become kind of dominant in the economy now, and I think the very simple answer there is the same. Too big to fail, too big to have. Right? So if any company is so big that we can't afford for it to fail, it can't be allowed to operate in a free market because the risk is simply too great of the system, as we saw with those investment banks in that period of time. So if companies are too big to fail, they should be broken up. Not nationalised, not destroyed, just broken up so that we don't have any one point of exposure that is too great. That's just good risk management.
Let's have our next audience question.
Hi, thank you. I'm wondering what impact do you think some of the changes like the EPA GHG reporting requirement and the SEC asking companies to report climate change as a material financial risk to their business, what impact can some of those changes have on investment and allocation of capital? And
Paul Gilding, you work with corporate leaders. I mean, are they is the government prompting them to pay more risk, to put more attention to carbon risk?
Definitely, no question. And I think we should separate the process of psychological change from the process of physical economic change. And I think that the issue about reporting, you know, as the questioner said about reporting on greenhouse gas emissions and so on, is actually very important because companies are used to measuring and reporting and then acting on things that they measure and report. So the very process of having to have it on your balance sheet or having to have it in some public report. And the historical example in the US was the toxic release inventory, right? And I know because I worked with DuPont after that time, but when the toxic release inventory came out, which listed just the sheer pounds of pollutants the companies were putting out, and suddenly DuPont was the world's biggest polluter.
Got their attention.
They didn't want to be the world's biggest polluter. Now, that wasn't an economic change. It was a reputational, you know, sort of cultural change. But those things are quite powerful. Now, people often say when they read my book, look, I say, so we should just wait for the crisis to come and not do anything now. And I said, no, wrong. Wrong answer. Everything we're doing now gets us ready for that crisis and gets us more able to respond. But many of these things are actually quite important training exercises. Now, we're going to go on a sort of combined marathon sprint when this begins. Right? It's going to last, as Richard said, for decades, but it's going to be a sprint to get there. So the more training we do for that moment, the better off we're going to be when the time comes.
If you're just joining us on the radio, this podcast of this and other Climate Run programs are available in the iTunes store, searching for Climate One. Let's have our last audience question.
Hi. I don't know if I heard you correctly, but did you say that the future and current economics depends on a current global temperature in the Earth's atmosphere or the temperature of the Earth currently and the variation upon 1 degree of that or 2 degrees? So what is that number that our planet needs to exist at to be economically stable?
Mm-hmm.
And then beyond that number, because I didn't know that, and then beyond that number, everybody knows the less energy put out there on efforts of project is less energy exerted, and of course, you know, less pollution would lead to reducing global climate warming. But we are moving closer to the sun, so that's a natural warmth. So what is the equation of that impact on the current Earth's atmosphere and rotation and all the combined efforts? And then I never hear about cooling effects. Mm-hmm. What can we do to cool our environment if our environment is, and what you said today, financially determined it upon this one number and the variation of that from 1 to 2? I mean, and then you have a battle if it's 2 then, and
Thank
not
you.
1, and it's going to...
Sure.
I mean, what, you know, what should we be doing?
Yeah, look, just, I mean, it's a complicated science question, but let me try and summarise that. Is if we go past 2 degrees of warming, and that's 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, the economy gets very hard to sustain, right? So that's sort of the number we know. Beyond that, we're kind of in crisis. Probably above 1 degree above pre-industrial levels, we almost can't cope, and that's really questionable at that point. And so I think the answer is that, and all those other issues about getting closer to the sun, the Earth's axis and so on, are all legitimate variations in climate, but not irrelevant to our time frame, right? So they're all very marginal in the time frame that we're concerned about. Over tens of thousands of years, they matter. But over our 100 years, it's all about our impact. And that's the only thing we have to worry about.
And you also believe that some limited reversible geoengineering would be advisable?
Well, back to the cooling issue is that, yes, we know a variety of safe ways that we can influence the global climate by reflectivity, for example. Now, putting sulfur in the atmosphere is a disaster, right? There are some really stupid ideas out there, but there are some good ideas out there about increasing reflectivity, about taking CO2 out of the atmosphere and burying it, right? There's a variety of ways you can do it. It's quite expensive, but it's a lot cheaper than the collapse of civilization, which is very expensive.
I think we have to end it there. Our thanks to Richard Heinberg and Paul Gilding for their comments here at Climate One. Thank you all for coming.
Hakuna Matata. What a wonderful phrase. Hakuna Matata. Ain't no peasant craze. It means no worries for the rest of your days. It's our problem-free philosophy. Hakuna Matata. Why, when he was a young warthog.
When I was a young warthog.
Very nice.
Thanks.
He found his aroma lacked a certain appeal. He could clear the savannah after every meal.
I'm a sensitive soul, though I seem thick-skinned. And it hurt that my friends never stood downwind. And oh, the shame.
He was a shame.
What a change in my name.
Oh, what's in a name?
Downhearted!
How did you feel?
Every time that I...
Hey, Pumba, not in front of the kids.
Oh, sorry.
Hakuna Matata. What a wonderful phrase. Hakuna Matata. Ain't no passing craze.
It means no worries for the rest of your days.
Yes, yeah, sing it, kid. It's our problem-free philosophy.
Hakuna Matata.
Hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But while you swelter down there in your shelter, you can see me on your TV. While we're attacking frontally, watch Brinkley and Huntley, describing contrapuntally the cities we have lost. No need for you to miss a minute of the agonizing Holocaust. Yeah! Little Johnny Jones, he was a U.S. pilot, and no shrinking violet was he. He was mighty proud when World War III was declared. He wasn't scared, no siree. And this is what he said on his way to Armageddon. So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But though I may roam, I'll come back to my home, although it may be a pile of debris. Remember, mommy, I'm off to get a commie, so send me a salami and try to smile somehow. I'll look for you when the war is over, an hour and a half from now.
I wish it was deeper than that. It's not. From the age of 15 to the grave, that's it. I'd like a beer and I'd like to see something naked. You go to a nursing home, you see a 90-year-old man going down the hall on a walker, that's what he's thinking. Well, I'd like a beer and I'd like to see something naked. Oh, not that, not that. And I do believe women understand men better than men understand women. What do you think? Think about that one. How often do you see a man stomp out of the room crying and a woman going, what? What'd I say? Come back here. But if women understand men better, it's because they study us. Have you ever seen women's magazines and the articles in them? It's always things like how to get a good man. How to get rid of a bad man. How to turn a bad man into a good man. You ever look at men's magazines? It's nothing but pictures of naked women. That's what we're after right there, fellas. There she is. Ooh, somebody get me a beer. And I do believe men would take advice about relationships, but we're not going to read magazine articles about it. You've got to give it to us in some form where we'd accept it. Now, sneak it into the play-by-play of ball games. And there's strike three. Greg Maddux really looking good today. And speaking of looking good, fellas, from time to time, your woman needs to be reminded that she's still looking good to you. Hey, baby! Have I told you lately you are as pretty as Greg Maddux? Baby! I will say this, in 13 years, my wife and I have created a beautiful home together. By that, I mean she created it, and we're together. Actually, we do have a beautiful home, and it's all my wife's doing, everything in it. She went out and found it, she bought it, she brought it home. I'm the mule. She'll come home and she'll say, there's a grandfather clock in the back of the truck. I'm like, hee-haw, hee-haw, hee-haw. People go through our house and go, that's really pretty. Is that rosewood? I don't know, but it's really heavy, I'll tell you that. I'd like to kill myself bringing that in here. And any guy that's thinking about getting married, I got a little piece of advice for you. Don't be too attached to any furniture you might currently have, because it is going away. Might be going to the basement, might be going to live with God, but it's going away. The day after we got married, my wife was walking through the house talking to my furniture like a flight attendant at the end of a flight. Bye-bye, bye-bye, bye-bye. Thanks for coming, bye-bye. See you at the dump. See you at the dump? Baby, that's a combination coffee table cooler. Look, the lid comes up. It's got a picture of Heather Locklear on it. But since she did create this beautiful home, I do feel as the man of the family, it's my obligation to protect the place. I think that's just something instinctual within men. We always feel like we got to protect our stuff. Even if it's not worth protecting, we want to protect it. You ever seen people have like a piece of crap Pinto with a club on the steering wheel? Somebody breaks the window, steals the club, leaves the Pinto in a pile of glass. But since the beginning of time, men have always felt like we had to defend the cave. Whenever you go out and look at a new place to live, women walk through it going, I wonder what kind of wallpaper I'm going to put in here. Men are like, somebody's going to try to get in that window, I guarantee you. That's the way we think, isn't it, guys? Even down to the yards. See, a lot of different theories on this one. A lot of guys like to keep their grass cut really short so they can see the intruders coming. Keep those kill zones open, you know. I say let the grass grow tall so they don't know there's a house behind it. Some call it lazy, I say it's thinking. Well, put yourself into the mind of a thief. Say you come up on two houses, and one of them has a manicured lawn with daisies growing in the flower pot. You might be thinking, well, that's easy pickings. But You come up on a house where the grass is this tall, and there's a dog chained to the clothesline and a motor swinging in the tree, buddy, that's a house where a gun lives. If you want to find out what kind it is, just crawl through the window after dark. And trust me, I am not insinuating women cannot take care of themselves. I know in 1998 you can. Matter of fact, you'd probably a lot rather deal with me than my wife. Because you break into my house, I will shoot you. My wife will shoot you and then spend 30 minutes telling you why she shot you. I shot you for coming through the window like that. You know, you ought to get a job like the rest of us. I was up at 5:45 this morning. I had to make lunch for the kids, then I had to take them to school, then I had to go to work myself. At lunch hour, I had to go get my driver's license renewed, then I had to stop by the grocery store on the way home. Are you listening to me? Are you listening to me? If you bleed on my rug, I'm going to shoot you again.
Well, since my baby left me, I found a new place to dwell. I get so lonely, baby. I get so lonely, baby. I get so lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, still can find some room. The broken heart and love found the fine way to move. And I get so lonely, baby. I get so lonely, baby. I get so lonely, I could die.
I get so lonely, baby. I get so lonely, I have to die.
So if your baby leaves you, you gotta tell the tale. To take you all down lonely street to a heartbreak hotel.
I get so lonely, baby. I get so lonely, baby. I get so lonely, I have to die. I get so lonely, baby. I get so lonely, baby. I get so lonely, I could die. And I get so lonely, I could die.
Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again. That's all, folks.